But I can't help it. When I was growing up back in the Pleistocene era, we had Diet Right Cola. Does anybody remember Diet Right Cola? You do? Really? Oh, I feel better already. We had Diet Right Cola with returnable bottles. You got a nickel for each bottle. That was big money if you were a kid in 1962.
Yeah.
I do like it. It's not my fave, but I do like it, yeah.
Can I give it to you? I got this whole thing of it that my nephew brought, and we don't drink it. And I hate to throw things out. They say it's good for killing slugs in your garden.
Yeah.
Well, that's just because you're drowning them. Water would be just as good. Sure. Do I need to write a thank you for tax purposes?
No.
No, it's not returnable anymore. Instead, we have plastic in our landfills. That's an improvement, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hey. Sometimes I think the world should have stopped in 1965.
Man, that's the year we got married.
Really? Very nice. What?
A very good year.
65 was a very good year, yeah. You know, it was before a lot of terrible things started to happen. Vietnam was not yet a thing. We were in the middle of the civil rights movement and making progress. It was a good time.
Yeah. Now, Vietnam drove my husband to graduate school at that time.
Yeah. No, a lot of people were in the same boat. The people who didn't want to go and live in Canada, or the people who didn't want to shoot off their big toe, or whatever it is they were going to do. And I was in the lottery. They got up to number 111, and I was number 114. We had a party. Who wanted to go? Nobody wanted to go. So that was truth be told, that was a middle class phenomenon. You know, people who were, if you weren't in the middle class, you didn't sweat that thing out nearly as much. You know, for some people, it was a step up. I don't like to say that, but it's true in terms of a job.
It's still true today.
It's true. I don't know if it's always been true, because for a long period of time we had a volunteer army and it was a different kind of business. But once we started to go to a system of mercenaries, then that changed. You know, so now people go, they've always got to some degree, but it really started, you know, when it started to change historically? After the Second World War with the GI Bill. That's the first time there ever was a serious financial benefit for being in the military. Otherwise, it was like, you know, terrible pay, and you got your uniform, and that was about it.
Also, very good when times are bad, recessions and such.
I'm sorry, could you speak up, please?
Times are bad.
Yes.
Recessions and such. Jobs are hard to find.
That's right.
So young men go into the army, into the military, for work.
Yeah.
Jobs.
And that's still true today for a lot of people.
It's especially true.
Yeah. Well, you say, quote, I think we really are coming out of recession. But be that as it may, it's still not, you know, primo employment time, no matter how you look at it. And although some things have opened up over the years that were closed before, not as much as you might think, sad to say. Although, some groups have benefited more than others. When my father, may he rest in peace, came back from the army, during the Second World War, he wanted to be a chemistry teacher, but he couldn't do that. He had to help support his family, so he went into industrial polishing and plating. And when he did that, he joined a lot of people who were doing stuff they had to do because they couldn't do the stuff they really wanted to do. There's a whole generation of men, and for different reasons and in different ways, women, who lived as adults with working at something they didn't want to do every day of their lives. And you figure, okay, so what is the impact of that from a broad sociological perspective? What does it mean when the folks who should be your leaders and the folks who should be the bulwark of the middle class are inordinately unhappy with what they do every day of their lives. What happens to people's attitudes, their point of view, et cetera, when they see that they're doomed to a life of not work or career, but of toil, you know? And my father was not alone. There was, I'd say, a whole generation of people like this. GI Bill was great, but then you couldn't get a job in those fields. So you wound up doing all sorts of things. The first business my father had after the Second World War was selling cosmetics. What did my father know about cosmetics? It was a ridiculous job for him, but it was a job. You know, see, that's what happened to a lot of people. And now that's happening again. Yeah.
It makes me think we just studied the session before on studying Talmud. You know,
yeah.
The value of it and all that. And so I think there's sort of a tradition of the people studying Torah. That was their primary thing. And then any job they had or skill to, you know, to support their family was secondary.
That might be a little overstated, but it's essentially right. The principle is Torah im derech eretz. Torah, you know. Im means with. Derech eretz means literally the way of the land. What it means is what the hoi polloi do, the average person. Okay, sort of common or vulgar, but not in a dirty sense. Vulgar in the sense of common, kind of life. So the idea always was that there was a necessity, but also a good thing about doing Torah and Derech Eretz, both. The idea that rabbis did their rabbinical work as a career for which they were paid was disapproved of in most of Jewish history. Everybody had some... You know, it's true? What?
Rambam.
There are many, many, many examples, Rambam being one. But the point I'm making is that I wouldn't say that making money or living was entirely secondary, but that's the part that needed regulation in order to make sure it didn't overwhelm the other part. If you are a salaried employee, or you own a business, or you have a profession, you know that the demands of your work can expand to fill whatever time there is. That's what they do. You know, nature abhors a vacuum, especially when it comes to labor. Whereas nothing forces you to expand your activities in Torah into free time and so on and so forth. There's nobody clamoring for you to do extracurricular study of Torah. Okay? So if in the battle between competing demands, work is always going to outstrip Torah study. That's just the natural position that people are in. So the stricture comes on the other side. You have to limit the working side, because that's the one that poses the threat of becoming overwhelming. Okay? It doesn't necessarily imply that it's less important. And the reason that it doesn't necessarily imply that it's not important is you can do Torah in many ways, including through the work that you do. So the fact that you're doing work does not mean you must therefore not be doing Torah. Studying Torah is one way of doing Torah, but it's not the only way of doing Torah. So in some ways, the goal of doing Torah is to do it through means that are not necessarily isolating or special or in some kind of hermetically sealed domain. Okay? So, you know, when we talk about taking Shabbat into the week with us, for example, or, whether it's at Chazal or some other time, what we mean is exactly that we go back into the week. We don't, you know, live in an ashram or whatever it is and stay away from everyday work. We go back into the regular week, the regular society, but we bring the Torah values with us so that we can transform the everyday through those values. That what doesn't happen if you don't do that work. Yeah. This is going to be an alternative study session, obviously.
Okay, so, I was talking about, Torah study being really thrilling in the idea realm, so that would carry over, if you're doing something you hate, at least you can be thinking these uplifting ideas.
Sure.
And all this stuff. On the other hand, if you're not interested in study, that's not your thing, and you do Torah and mitzvot and things in your job, but you hate your job, that's, to me, a huge challenge.
It is a challenge.
It's like real sacrifice. It's like, you know, like they say in Buddhism, loving washing the dishes and doing it because you're doing it as a service.
Yeah, if you're the Dalai Lama, I guarantee you, you're not washing dishes. Okay? If you are, you know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you're not washing dishes. Okay? You're not doing any of those kinds of things. But here's the thing. For Judaism, religion is, at root, a practical enterprise. Okay? It is significant because it interacts with life. And by that interaction, or through that interaction, it changes life. And you yourself become an agent of change. See, I'm suddenly getting to my topic. And the point of that is that the pragmatic concerns of work and careers and so on and so forth, and child rearing, and all these things we do every day that takes up most of our time, are not lost. You know, you think about it the other way around. So let's say Torah just applies to its special domain. Okay? Then what am I doing the rest of the time? I'm doing stuff that doesn't matter. I'm doing stuff that doesn't count. Now, you want to talk about something that's challenging and depressing, that's challenging and depressing. Okay? You're taking care of your kids, but it doesn't really matter. I really should be studying Torah. Or I'm making a living for my family and supporting them, but that doesn't really matter. I really should be studying Torah. And you are always where you're not, supposed to be and not where you're supposed to be. You following me? Yeah, so it's actually a good thing to have this interpenetration of Torah and Derech Eretz. They are mutually supportive, really. Okay? Yes, sir. And this is going to be the last question that isn't our topic.
Just that there
is... I'll let you ask the question, too.
No, I'm just saying, I don't think there's a disconnect there in a modern world, because I have a smartphone.
Yeah.
I mean, it may not be.
Do you read Daf notes?
I read a lot of Ori.
Okay.
They're very harsh. But I'm just saying, it's not difficult to just knock out 5-10 minutes of my lunch hour.
No, but you see, what you're doing is you're using the technology as a tool. Technology is not the end in itself. And that's the point. Almost anything can be a tool if you use it that way, including stuff that could be otherwise distracting, okay? If you're the kind of person that my daughter is, and you have your phone with you, I guarantee you, no matter how she starts off studying, it winds up on a page about, God, I don't even want to say. You know, because the technology is too powerful, and it carries you along, you know. So in your case, you're making a good use of it, a very reasoned and logical use that requires a certain amount of focus, not to be waylaid by other things that are just a little button away. Okay? So, you know, you think about it, in a lot of ways, technology has been perceived to be, over the years, kind of the enemy of study and learning. Technology always starts out on one level or another as kind of a bright, shiny object. Look what I can do. Isn't that amazing? And over a period of time, it becomes routinized. And it's not so shiny anymore. It's not so new anymore. And it can become more of a tool when that happens. But at the beginning, it's distracting. You know, years ago, I was what some people call an audiophile. You know what that is? Okay. So I was reading magazines and books and whatnot all about different audio products, different components, and how many, what range of frequencies could this receiver reproduce, and how sensitive was the needle, and so on and so forth. All these questions, until one day I realized, A, I couldn't afford any of this stuff. And the reason you can't afford any of the stuff is that once you buy it, it's obsolete, yes. But the worst part of something being obsolete is you can't have it. Because you just shelled out X amount of dollars for this now obsolete piece of junk. This now, you know, doorstop. Okay? And everybody says, oh, you got one of those? Yeah, I got this thing. So it's new. Oh, yeah, really? How nice. I'm delighted to hear all about your new Onkyo tuner or whatever it was. Yeah. So it conjures up envy and jealous, coveting and all sorts of terrible things, besides the fact that you're frustrated because you can't buy it. And you're listening to the music, which is perfectly fine. You're saying to yourself, yeah, how much better would this sound if it got a little bit lower on the bottom end of the frequency range? Well, you know, maybe a whale could hear it. but as a human being, you can't, you know. But that's the psychology of it, you know. So after a while, it just became a way of listening to music. And I didn't care anymore. Okay, I let somebody else spend thousands of dollars on an NAD tuner, or whatever. So anyhow, I want to talk about social change, which is what we were kind of talking about already, because one of the things that is very, very salient about the Jews is we are busybodies in everybody's business, and we want to change the world to make it better for everybody who's all around us. We even try to make it better for ourselves from time to time. But that's not where the greater part of our energy is in terms of social change. Now, let me back up. Here's a term that we love called social change. In Hebrew, is there a term that roughly correlates to social change?
Tikkun olam.
Tikkun olam. Thank you so much, and how wrong you are. No, you're right. You're right. That's how we use it. That is how we use it, but it's not its original meaning. Are you bringing an offering? No. Okay. Yeah, okay. Does anybody know what Tikkun olam originally means? By the way, what are we doing today? Tikkun Leil Shavuot. Same word, right? What does tikkun mean?
Return.
No, that's a good guess, but no. See, I was a teacher of a certain kind. I would say, that's a very interesting answer. What do you mean by that? No, I'm just going to tell you no. It's not true. Yeah. Yeah. What were you going to say? Tikkun? Nobody knows what tikkun means?
Repair.
What does it mean? Repair is a good translation, and in the modern context, that's the kind of translation that we would use, but it's not the original translation. In the prayer book, it says we're supposed to l'taken olam b'malchut Shaddai. L'taken olam, to repair the world. We got that part, right? L'taken olam b'malchut Shaddai, with the rulership, the sovereignty of God. What does that mean? How is the sovereignty of God expressed? How do you show that God is the sovereign? You study Torah in order to do Torah.
Mitzvot,
of course. So the kind of correction we're talking about originally in this term Tikkun Olam, L'taken Olam B'Malchut Shaddai, is about getting the world to operate in terms of the mitzvot. Okay? That's not the same thing as social change. Okay, are we together about that? Now, where this idea that Tikkun Olam means repairing the world of social change and so on and so forth, where did that come from? It came from people like Martin Luther King. Because for them, the idea of the civil rights movement, there are other movements of that sort that Jews were involved with, as well as many other kinds of people, it was infused because of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Council, with a very strong religious and particularly biblical content. These were ministers, certainly many of them, and their words were peppered with quotations from both Bibles and so on and so forth. You couldn't, if you look up the list of people who are SCLC leadership, they're all reverends. Okay? Ralph Albert Abernathy, I mean, you go down the list. So, American Civil Rights Movement, from the beginning, was a combination of religion, particularly biblical or Christian-oriented religion, and what else would be involved? Who were constantly telling the Jews and through them the other people that they were screwing up?
Everybody.
Who?
Everybody.
Everybody. You are so cynical, Stuart. I'm sorry. Not everybody. There were people who didn't even know us. They didn't know to say that. Yes? Prophets, exactly. By the way, do you know why Bernie Sanders wears his hair the way he does? Because he is conjuring up the image of the prophet, the biblical prophet. Think about it. You'll see I'm right. Okay, so the particular kind of Judaism involved, particular kind of biblical religion, was the prophetic strain. Martin Luther King was not quoting the book of Leviticus. He was quoting the prophets. Okay, and why? Because he saw the situation in the United States the same way, from a certain angle, that the prophets saw Israel in antiquity. That there was a society that was basically unfair, that people didn't treat each other properly, that the rich were in a different position than the poor in these ways, that people were not treating each other as equal creations in the image of God, and so on and so forth. All the things that the Bible was, the prophets of the Bible were railing against. It's, by the way, one of the things that made King's speeches so powerful. If you look, for example, at the way he structured his speeches, the best example being his best speech, the I Have a Dream speech, he picks up the rhythms of the prophets perfectly. That's what he's doing. And now, did he think of himself as some kind of biblical prophet? I don't think he did. Maybe he did. But it didn't matter. He knew what they sounded like. And he knew that using language in a certain way was going to strike people and move people in a certain way. And that was a worthwhile literary form to emulate because he's going to want to have a certain kind of effect. Okay? So there's this component in the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. And even before King. You know, King was not the first by any means. There was always a marriage between biblical religion and the civil rights movement in the United States from a very early time. Here's an example of something I find that was really interesting. I guarantee you will not be able to tell me the name of any of these people, but do you know the names of any of the founders of the NAACP? You know, the NAACP was founded in 1912 in the United States. It's an ancient civil rights organization. Do you know anybody who was among the founders? Yeah. We're back there. Sorry? W.E.B. Du Bois, no. Although he was involved in civil rights, yes. But he was not a founder of the organization. Not all, but many of them were Jewish. Horowitz and others. The legal director, and I mean, a whole bunch of these leaders were Jewish. What were they doing there? How did they wind up being involved in founding the NAACP? What's the rationale as a Jew for being involved in the founding of such an organization? Yes, of course, but not everybody, even people who are heirs of the biblical tradition who are not Jews, felt that way.
If you advance someone else's civil rights, you advance your own.
That's a very insightful point, because one of the things that the Talmud specifically enjoins upon us is that Jews have an obligation to see to justice for all the citizens of their land. And specifically goes on to say, because it promotes social stability, justice, etc. So it was a very utilitarian kind of idea. You should make sure that everybody is treated justly, because it's good for everybody if that's the case. If anybody is treated unjustly, it creates social unrest, the possibility of revolution, pain and suffering of various sorts and so forth. Very pragmatic. Okay?
Also floating all boats.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So there were all sorts of reasons that might have a religious source, but which were not necessarily moral and highfalutin, but which were very grounded in pragmatic politics.
Self-serving.
Well, but more than self-serving. Self-serving in the sense that everybody gets served, so you're itself, you know. But it was not necessarily the case that only Jews, it wasn't the case, that only Jews got an advantage from this. On the contrary. Yeah.
But on the other hand, in a situation like that,
yeah. That is the nub of the contradiction. How far do you go in trying to effect justice for everyone? Is there a point at which you have gone too far and you are now working against yourself? That's a reasonable question to ask. And it's a question that has been a dominant part of the thinking of social reform movements forever. If you think, for example, of the French Revolution. What happened to the French Revolution? At the beginning, the French Revolution was quite successful. But it became more and more extreme in trying to root out what it thought of as monarchist elements in the French population. And as it became more and more extreme, it undertook more and more extreme actions against certain individuals. And even if there wasn't real proof that somebody was, you know, a counter-revolutionary, they would make an example of him. You know, this is Madame de Forges sitting at the guillotine. And so, like all revolutions, ultimately it foundered because it began to produce effects that were contrary to the effects they wanted to have. That's an issue for any movement of social change. And when you think about it, you have to ask yourself the question, where does Judaism come down on this issue? And there are a variety of views on this, but I'll tell you what mine is for what it's worth. Judaism teaches what I would call a revolutionary incrementalism. Okay? The way it does this, Kim has studied with me, he knows what I'm going to say now. So if you want to go outside, take a smoke or whatever, you can do. Here's how it works. People are doing A, okay? And A, whatever it is, slavery, whatever, you know, who knows, whatever the social ill is, they're at A, this is what they do. It's commonly accepted in the cultures around them. Everybody has slaves, what are you talking about? And if you come into that environment, you say, okay, you cannot do this absolutely anymore, it's done. What do people do? Well, you just have to look at the newspaper today to see what people do in that kind of context. You tell them, okay, this is now legal, it used to be illegal. They go, what? We've always done it this way. How dare you legislate to me? How dare you take away my liberty and my decision making and so forth and tell me that I have to change what I'm doing? Fie on you and your government. Okay? So what's happening now? So the Torah, again, is very pragmatic. It says, okay, look, we're starting at A, we want to be at Z. How do we get from A to Z? Do we say to everybody right now, okay, we're now going to do Z. Everybody, page 25 in your hymnals, let's sing together. That's how it does. It says, okay, I want to move you from A to B. But it does it in such a clever way. It tells you, A, here's what we're doing now. Here's your new rule that's going to get you to B. But built into the new rule that's going to get you to B, if you begin to think about it, is that you're going to see that it also implies that it's going to have to take you to C. And if you think about it, you realize it implies you have to go to D. And if you go to D, you'll realize it takes you to E, and so on and so on and so forth. And you just follow it out, what's built in the original injunction itself, and by just following out its logic, you wind up at Z over time. That's how the Bible works. I shouldn't say that's how the Bible works. That's my theory. Okay, doesn't mean it's true, but I think it works out. I've been studying this stuff for a long time. Yes, I saw a hand. Yes, ma'am. No.
Right now in Austin,
yeah,
constructing roads that are going over the watershed of Barton Springs
is
getting ruined the way they're doing the toll roads, and they're doing these little increments, and people don't realize that they're trying to connect 35 and Mopac because they're just doing it in these little pieces, and people don't realize what's happening except the people who realize it. And they're trying to let other people know, but I don't know how.
Well, see, I'm talking about the other side of the ledger. I'm not talking about a rapacious incrementalism that's trying to take stuff away piece by piece by piece. That's also true, but that's not what the Torah is teaching. Torah is teaching how do you change the current situation, the status quo.
Okay.
And you do it by promulgating a mitzvah, a law, whatever, which seems only to require you moving from A to B. But which actually, as you unpack it, makes you move gradually from A to Z.
Yeah.
Okay? I'll give you an example of how it works out, okay? That's like, you know, airy-fairy stuff. So here's an example. In Judaism, are you allowed to have slaves or not? In Bible. Yes, you are.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. There's no question about it. Text is absolutely clear. Okay. So it's, yeah.
Well, how about separate but equal? Is that an incremental change?
Well, it doesn't talk about separate equal. The Bible doesn't talk about that.
No, I know, but in Stuart, civil rights.
Was that progress when it occurred?
Yes, it was progress when it occurred. Because all the societies around it, they had rules like the famous Code of Hammurabi, the Blessed Code of Hammurabi, which is remarkable. So in the Code of Hammurabi, let's say you killed somebody. The Bible says, look, doesn't matter if a person is rich or poor, whatever it is, everybody gets treated the same. In the Code of Hammurabi, that's not true. In the Code of Hammurabi, if the person that you kill is a, you know, member of the hoi polloi, you get a fine. If the person you kill is a member of the nobility, on the other hand, then you're put to death. Why is that? Because the person who is a member of the hoi polloi only has an economic value. They're a laborer. And they are worth what their labor is worth. That's all. Life is not, in the Code of Hammurabi, an absolute value. But in the Bible, it is an absolute value. And the reason that that Bible has capital punishment, we can talk about this later too if you want, is that only life is equivalent to life. What happens when you say, all right, you murdered something, fine. It cost you $10, it cost you $100, it cost you $1,000. What you're saying is that life has a certain value. We can compute it, we can crunch the numbers, we can do whatever we want to do with it, and once you have paid the amount, you're clear. Is that what we really mean by life is an ultimate value? I don't think so. So life is the only equivalent of life. The rabbis say, look, we don't want to go killing anybody. That's not good either. So you got to keep capital punishment on the books, but you don't want to invoke it. That's a conundrum, right? Does anybody know what the rabbi's solution is? Yeah.
Well, like for breaking Shabbat, it was...
Now, I'm not talking about breaking Shabbat. I'm specifically talking about murder. Right.
One who had to tell you not
That's
to
right.
do it and everything else. And
those are the two main ones.
Okay. And the same thing with the rebellious child.
Yes.
The bar was set so high that the story goes, it was never implemented.
In the case of the Ben Surer or Morer, there are other things that happen as well. Like, for example, you have to make this a public matter. You have to go to the gates of the city, which is where the legal judgments take place. It's like a court of law. And you have to declare your incompetence as a parent in front of these judges. That's a really high bar. But the point is, you're absolutely right, if there aren't witnesses, the actual act, that doesn't mean they see a person go into the room, two people go walk into the room, and only one of them walks out. They are not witnesses. They have to see the actual murderous act, A, and they have to have warned the possible murderer that that you know you're not supposed to do this.
Yeah. You talk about the motive?
Sorry?
The
who?
Extrajudicial killing, the motive about stopping.
No, I'm talking about any murder.
And if the Sanhedrin was unanimous,
mm-hmm.
that was problematic also. It had to be a dissenter.
Well, that's a little bit, that is a related issue, but there are some other issues involved in that. But
be. A high bar.
Yeah, it's very high bar, and that was their solution. So, not saying that capital punishment is forbidden, but they're not saying that it's not forbidden. It is very rare. Now, there is a reason why the state of Israel has executed only one person in its 68-year-old history. Anybody know who that was?
Eichmann.
There are plenty of people who are guilty of capital murder. None of them except Eichmann was executed. Why?
That's official execution.
Sorry?
There's a lot of executions.
In Israel?
Not in Israel, but outside of Israel. You know, the Palestinian terror.
You know what? We can talk about this another time. But that is a matter that is, what do I want to say? Under investigation. And there are very good reasons why it's under investigation. And if you want to, the last thing we're going to do today, if you start quoting the foreign minister of Denmark or any of those people to me, is we're going to cut the class short. Okay? Because it's a bunch of malarkey. Yeah?
I want to return to the question of gradualism.
Oh, okay, great.
Because I have an example that's always bothered me. It has to do with slavery.
Yeah.
In the United States and how we handled it.
Mm-hmm.
Slavery.
Okay, I'm not familiar with what they did in Brazil. Can you tell me?
I can't give the exact dates, but let's say around 1845 or something.
Yeah.
All children born of slaves were free. And then, you know, about 5, 6, 7 years later, I believe all men, maybe all people, over the age of 70 were free.
Mm-hmm.
So this was an example of gradualism that eliminated slavery from Brazil around 1885.
Okay.
After our Civil War. By contrast, we had this terrible war.
Right.
Killed, I don't know, 600,000-700,000 people.
Right.
And I never understood why we put Lincoln on a pedestal for
engineering
this war. When we could
have. He did what?
Huh?
He engineered the war, is that what you said?
Well, it's like he was a president during this time.
Yeah.
When, you know, here we basically eliminated property in the South.
Oh, please. Did I attract all the folks from the loony bins tonight?
You're looking for an example of gradualism versus...
Well, I think there's gradualism in Brazil, as you describe it to me. I'm no expert on it. I do know a little something about the Civil War, and what I'm hearing from you is old post-Reconstructionist revisionism by pro-Southern writers. There is not a word of that stuff that's true. Read Shelby Foote on the matter. Read, Howard Zinn. Read, there's Scadiate authors who debunk that nonsense. And you really ought to broaden your reading. What in the hell is happening here?
I got an example.
Yeah, okay.
When the Torah talks about the slave, talks about taking care of the slave. If you have a pillow, only one pillow, you give
yeah.
the slave.
Yeah.
Yes. The surrounding area. And from that we extrapolate, that's A to B.
Right.
And then B to C is your Jewish slave. And then Z is, well, probably about M is no slave, and Z is equality.
Yeah. Those are all interim steps, yeah.
The living Torah, was supposed to be living and changing.
Yeah.
Written down in the Talmud. Yehuda Nasi, although that's another whole topic, but it was supposed to be living and changing dynamic, and that would have gotten us from A to Z, as you use your analogy.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. The interesting part of all that is that it all starts as a mitzvah, as halakha, really. And when one draws conclusions from it, it's basically this process of trying to understand the limitations of the original halakha. Now, for example,
you do better than your neighbors.
Well, all right. So, you begin to say, all right, so what exactly is this term neighbor? How do we define it? Once you say neighbor, you say, okay, as a fellow Israelite. Okay. Well, you begin to expand it, because all of a sudden these are people out there that you're connected with in one way or another who are, as it happens to be, a neighbor in this expanding world you're living in, and so on and so forth. So all of a sudden, who gets counted in this under this rule changes, as one example of how it changes. There are others as well. The point is, it's all part of the original halakha, and just by pursuing what that halakha means, it broadens itself. You don't have to add to it. You don't have to re-litigate it. And if we want to talk about the United States, where there are a lot of mistakes about Reconstruction, one of them was that it didn't adopt this model. Whether it's the Brazilian model or whatever the model might be, the solution, as the northern firebrands wanted it to be, was to say, Hotazoi, that's the way it's going to be, end of story, and you're going to do this. Instead of doing what Lincoln wanted to do, which was to gradually move in that direction and to open things up step by step. You know, the interesting thing about Lincoln, who is not exactly a civil liberties champion in a lot of ways, he did have a very good feel for what would work politically and what would not. He was probably the number one practical politician in U.S. history. I mean, he got things passed that no one else would have succeeded in doing, because he was a great practical politician, and he knew that you don't jump from A to Z if you want to get anything done. He knew that you had to come at it from a different kind of angle. And that's one of the things, by the way, that has doomed us in recent years. Things that people are unhappy about, maybe it's right. Not maybe, but many of the things that the government wants us to do are right. But when you promulgate things, you say, okay, we're going to move to Z in one fell swoop, people tend to get up on their hind legs, even if they think or they know that it's the right thing to do in their heart of hearts. And certainly if they don't know it's the right thing to do in their heart of hearts. So one of the things I want to get at with this notion of Judaism and social change is, in the United States anyway, with some exceptions, Jews were involved in social change movements that were incremental. Now, there are exceptions. One of the things I want to pass out to you is a handy-dandy little article. Oh, thank you, Kim. From Wikipedia, that source of all sources, which you know is absolutely true all the time. But this is the kind of article that Wikipedia can do right, because it's just a list of names. It's a list of what they call quote-unquote Jewish activists. And the first thing I want you to notice about this list is that it is extensive, even for Wikipedia. And it leaves out some important names on the list. The second thing I want to point out to you is that there are both mostly liberals, but some appreciable number of conservatives who are on the list. So Jews are not only involved in social change movements that are on the left or on the liberal side, but also to a somewhat lesser degree on the conservative or the right-wing side. The next thing I want you to notice about the list is that it is very broad. There is no area of social change or social reform that Jews were not involved in leadership capacities. It's amazing. What the heck do we do in half of these areas? They don't necessarily directly impinge upon Jewish life. But on the theory that we were talking about before, of society being better, it's something good for everybody, including for us. And what you have is reason for Jews to be involved in all sorts of activities as social change agents, even if they don't necessarily hit at Jews directly. Here's a good example, one of these little factoids that I just love. Since the Second World War, what do you think the average Jewish vote for the president has been? What percentage of Jews vote for the Democratic candidate, and what percentage of Jews vote for the Republican candidate?
Well, parties have changed.
I know.
Since when?
Since 1945.
More Democrats.
More Democrats. How much more? 80-20. You know, that's unusual because most people underestimate it. No, it's not quite that much. It's about 70-75% for the Democrats over that period of time, and rest Republicans. Jews voted more for Eisenhower than they have for other Republican candidates. So those two terms, there was a higher percentage of Jews voting for Republicans because Eisenhower was a war hero, et cetera, et cetera. And Adlai Stevenson was perceived as being soft on communism and so on and so forth. So Eisenhower got a disproportionately larger number of Jews to vote for him than is usually the case. In the last election with Obama, it was about 76-77%. Now, you have to ask yourself the question, why? Where does that come from? And the reason I ask the question is, if you were just to look at sort of a narrow view of the social, economic, and political interests that Jews have, what party would they be voting for? The Republicans, overwhelmingly. They'd be like Presbyterians. No, they would be voting 50, 60, or more percent for Republicans. The Jews and the Episcopalians and the Presbyterians are in about the same position economically and socially in the United States. Jews economically a little bit better off than the Presbyterians, which is saying something. But those are the comparable groups. What some people like to say is the Jews live like Presbyterians but vote like Catholics. Okay? And that's true. We are constantly voting against what are our perceived economic and social interests. Why is that? Would there be anything wrong? We voted for candidates that were better suited to our class or our group or whatever it is. No, not any more than it would be bad. It's bad for Presbyterians to vote for those guys. Why do we not do that? Any theories?
Well, the ones who were leaders and the industrial leaders and everything, a lot of them were anti-Semitic, for one thing.
At a certain period of time, that was very true. Now it's less true, but it's still true to some degree. My father, may he rest in peace, after the Second World War, I told you a little bit about his travails. He applied for a job at Dutch Boy Paint. I think they still make Dutch Boy Paint, but it's not a major brand like it used to be. It used to be Dutch Boy was the number one brand in the United States. And in the period after the Second World War, my father applied for a job at Dutch Boy Paint, not knowing that it was a restricted firm in terms of its hiring practices. So he didn't get a job there. And he found out afterwards that they just didn't hire Jews. So sorry. They're just not part of the people that we hire here.
More like Dutch Deutsch Boy.
Sorry?
More like Deutsch Boy.
Deutsch Boy. Very good, bro. Mark, that's excellent. Yeah, I have to remember that. Thank you. Can I use that? So, all right.
I had another thing I was going to say, though. I think one thing that strikes me as an important factor in...
Yeah.
Christians in this country. But Jews are constantly, one thing Jews are constantly aware of is that they're a minority.
That is a very good point. And if I could, if you give me a second, I'd like to expand upon it just a little bit. Here's the interesting thing to me of that particular... Hi, it's not 9:30 yet, is it? Almost close. 10:30?
Have you gone 2 hours over?
No, just 10:30 now. Just change from 10:29 to 10:30.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You got a minute.
I got a minute. Oh, this is like the most important point that they made all night. Well, give me a
good
break.
Good for them. I don't know why they waited to make it.
You know, it's like in counseling appointments, people... You say, okay, the session's almost over, and the client says, oh, by the way, I killed my wife. Oh, really? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Our session is up.
Is that how that works?
That's how it works. Oh. That at a sliding scale. So, so what I'm saying here is, look, you're right. We know the heart of the stranger, okay? We are aware of what it means to be marginalized in society, and so we have an affinity for others who are marginalized. And, you know, as we say in the Seder every year, you have to be aware of the fact that you were slaves in Egypt. But it's not just that. If you want to read more about this, you read a historian named Carrie McWilliams. Along with a bunch of other historians, he points out that typically Jews are involved in high-risk, high-reward economic activities because nobody else wants to do them. Hmm. Which is why we were involved in the movie-making business and others. It was a high return if you're successful, but it's very hard to be successful, and nobody wants to do it, so Jews went and did it. And that's been our position economically for centuries, okay? That's exactly the same reason why Jews have been involved in social reform movements. What could be more unlikely to be successful than overturning centuries of slavery and its after effects in the United States? What project is more doomed to failure than trying to get rid of sexism? What, you know, just go down the list. These are all tilting in windmills. But that's what we do. That's our place in the world. In economics, in social endeavors, et cetera, et cetera. And so in an odd sort of way, that's how we're comfortable. I don't know what that says about us.
Well, do we think we're doomed to persecution anyway, so we might as well just, you know...
In for a penny, in for a pound, right? Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Shavua tov.